Instructional Dynamics Incorporated welcomes you to this weekly series of commentaries on the current economic scene. Reporting to you will be one of the nation's leading economists, Professor Milton Friedman of the University of Chicago. Dr. Friedman, before we begin the formal part of the discussion, I'd like to refer you to an item in the New York Times this morning which describes your debate with Professor Walter Heller at New York University yesterday. And I was wondering if we could begin by having you explain what was that all about.
Well, I'd be glad to. That was quite a nice debate. We had a good audience, an overflow group accommodated in closed-circuit TV. It's an annual event. NYU has a so-called Solomon Lectures. And as I was saying to Mr. Solomon, who, although he spells his name S-A-L, I was making a kind of a joke about the fact that NYU decided this year to follow King Solomon's advice and divide the baby into two parts and have two talks instead of one, namely Walter Heller talking on the question of whether is monetary policy being oversold, and myself talking on the question, is fiscal policy being oversold? Needless to say, Walter Heller's position was that, on the one hand, monetary policy is being oversold in the sense that I and people who follow the general view I do have stressed the enormous importance of changes in the quantity of money as opposed to fiscal changes. And in Walter Heller's view, we have carried that too far. In his view, my position and the position of others like me that we should have a steady rate of growth in the money supply seems to him like locking the steering wheel of a car driving along a road. You know, whenever people resort to metaphors, it always seems to me there's something wrong with their arguments. But at any rate, that was his position, and he defended it and presented it very well and stressed, of course, from his point of view, what he regarded as the enormous role which the tax cut of 1964 had played in promoting the rapid expansion in the economy subsequently. For my turn, I expressed the view that both monetary policy and fiscal policy were in fact being oversold. That is, I answered yes to both questions. What I argued was that what's being oversold is fine-tuning, is the idea that it is possible for a few people in Washington to turn a button here and turn a button there a little, and through delicate adjustments in taxes and in monetary policy affect the course of the economy in such a way as to keep it on a perfectly even keel. It has always seemed to me that there's an old saying that the best is sometimes the enemy of the good, that you try to achieve perfection and in the end, you don't do as well as if you hadn't tried so hard. And it seems to me that's the case here. If you try to achieve an absolutely perfect course, what you're going to do is to introduce large uncertainties into the economy, which will cause it to divert from that course. I've expressed this view over a long period, and it seems to me the evidence of the fine-tuning of the last 10 years brings it rather close to home and supports that view. But going down to more specific points, in my opinion, while both are being oversold, fiscal policy has been oversold in a different sense and to a far greater degree than monetary policy. The problem is that what Walter Heller and other people like him say is that, oh, of course money matters, but money isn't all that matters. And they accuse us, that is people like myself and our group, the so-called Chicago School, or monetarists as he was referring to us, they accuse us of saying that money is all that matters. Now, I argued that that was a straw man, that that isn't the position we've said, that it makes no sense to talk about is money all that matters unless you ask for what. If you're going to talk about happiness in marriage, well, money in the sense of income may marry, but it doesn't matter, but it isn't all that matters. And turning more directly to the economy, if you're going to talk about the long-run growth of the economy, of why it is that the U.S. has a tremendously productive society, why we are relatively affluent, I think that has very little to do with the quantity of money. That is determined by our resources, the kind of economic system we have, that we have a free enterprise system. It's determined by the fact that we have an able, effective, energetic people, lots of capital, and so on. Those are the factors that are really important. On the other hand, from the point of view of inflation, of price rise and price fall, from the point of view of what happens in the short period to the nominal quantity, nominal income, income expressed in dollars, not real income, well, their money, while it isn't all that matters, is, in my opinion, unquestionably the dominant factor. The quantity of money is the dominant factor in determining those changes. In my opinion, fiscal policy, on the other hand, while it's important for some things, again, matters for what? It matters greatly in terms of
what fraction of the nation's resources are going to be devoted to governmental rather than to private uses. It matters greatly in determining what fraction of your income you're going to have to turn over to the government. But in my opinion, it has no significant influence on whether we have inflation or deflation, whether nominal income rises or falls, except as it influences monetary policy. And indeed, the great difficulty in this whole argument is to try to keep separate the influence of fiscal policy from the influence of monetary policy. You can do it, both intellectually and statistically, by separating out what happens to government deficits and surpluses on the one side and what happens on the other to the quantity of money. It's perfectly possible for the government to have a big deficit, but to finance it by borrowing it from the public at large rather than by printing more money. In that case, the quantity of money will not be affected. Now, the difficulty with the 1964 tax cut, for example, is that while the tax was cut, and the fiscalists would argue that that was the source of the expansion, it so happens that the quantity of money was increased very rapidly, particularly rapidly during the whole of that period, and therefore the monetarists can claim that what produced the expansion was a rising quantity of money. The hard question is, how do you separate these out? How do you hold the one constant and get the separate influence? Now, it so happens that there's been a lot of empirical work which has been directed towards separating them out, and most of my own talk was devoted to summarizing some of the empirical evidence that has been produced on this question. I made a study about 15 or 16 years ago comparing the Civil War, the First World War, and the Second World War from the point of view of whether the price behavior in those wars could be explained more nearly by the monetary forces, monetary changes between them, or by fiscal changes. And it turned out that the monetary changes gave you a very simple picture, the fiscal changes didn't. I've published and other people have published a considerable number of studies in the interim giving the same results for other periods. Most recently, and I want specially to mention this because some of you may want to try to get a hold of it, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis has just done a fascinating statistical study of the period 1952 to 1968. That's about the longest recent period for which you can do a study if you're going to get out of the troubles of the bond support program before 1951. That will appear, or has appeared, in the November bulletin of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. In this study, they have tried to separate out the separate influence of the monetary changes on the one hand, that is, the changes in the quantity of money, and the fiscal changes, that is, the changes in the high employment budget on the other, in expenditures and deficits. And the results are fascinating and striking. They find, essentially, to put it in its simplest terms, that the ups and downs of taxes have had no significant influence on the ups and downs of GNP, of the national income, or whatever measures of this kind. Ups and downs in taxes have had essentially no influence once you allow for and hold constant what happened to the quantity of money. On the other hand, they find that the ups and downs of expenditures, of government expenditures, have had an influence, but a very interesting influence. In the first two quarters after an increase in government expenditures, this tends to have an expansive influence on the economy. But in the next two quarters, it tends to have a contractionary influence, and for a year as a whole, it all washes out. Now, that's very, very sensible from the point of view of the theory I and others have promoted, because to begin with, the expenditures have an initial impact effect. It takes time for people to adjust to them. But then after if the government spends more, while it doesn't tax anymore, it has to borrow some more. This tends to raise interest rates, and that tends to produce a negative effect that wipes out the initial positive effect. On the other hand, they found that throughout the whole of that period, changes in the quantity of money had had a very regular, consistent, and significant influence on changes in GNP, that the changes in the quantity of money had an influence that took about three or four quarters to make itself felt, and they traced out the influence in the first quarter, the second, third quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. And they came to the conclusion that over a year as a whole, a change in the quantity of money had a very definite and significant and detectable influence on nominal income. Of course, I don't want to overstate their results. There was still a lot of noise, a lot of error. Taken together, the changes in the quantity of money and the changes in expenditures accounted for somewhere between 50 and 75% of the variation in GNP, but that still leaves quite a lot left. And I urge you to write, if you're not on the mailing list of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, to ask them to put you on their mailing list for their bulletin, because it so happens that that particular Federal Reserve Bank does some of the very best economic reporting of both statistics and analysis.
Well, it could be that everyone likes to live in St. Louis.
I doubt that very much. It's a very that really is a very surprising thing. You've got 12 Federal Reserve Banks. Every one of them publishes a monthly bulletin. Of all of those monthly bulletins, they're required by law, as you may know, to publish a monthly bulletin. Generally, over the history, 50-year history of the Federal Reserve, the New York Federal Reserve Bank has been the dominant one, and it does publish a good monthly bulletin. But in the last 5 or 10 years, thanks to the influence of one man who went to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Homer Jones, as a vice president, they have turned out to be the most important single bank in the system. It's a pure accident. Although it might be interesting to note a historical precedent. William McChesney Martin's father was at one time the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis.
So it has quite a nice history about it,
yes,
I guess.
It does.
Well, Dr. Friedman, we've just had an election, and Mr. Nixon is now the president-elect, and he'll be taking over in January. And I'm sure that many people are wondering what the nation's economic state will be under President Nixon. And there is some talk that Mr. Nixon won't have as much leeway in economic policy because of the Democratic Congress. Now, how do you react to that?
Well, there has been a lot of talk about that, and I think it's a very relevant point to consider. The talk has been that because of the narrowness of his election and the fact that the Congress came in Democratic, he's going to be stymied. Now, I personally don't believe that's the case. And the reason I don't believe that's the case is because I believe the word Democratic is a very misleading word. The fact is that a Democrat in New York and a Democrat in Arizona is a very different creature, or take any other state. Indeed, the most striking thing, if you look at a map of the electoral votes in the presidential election, the most striking thing is that what you had, that the crucial division was not Democratic versus Republican. It was New York and its satellite states versus the rest of the country. If you take New York, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, they provided Humphrey, if I remember the figures rightly, with more than half his electoral votes. Now, this is a very interesting phenomenon to speculate on, and I don't understand why it is that New York should be so influential, but B, so different from the rest of the country. But therefore, if you want to know what Congress's sentiments are about economic matters, it isn't a very good thing to look at it in terms of Democratic or Republican. You want to ask yourself a different question. What is the division in Congress between those people, whether Democratic or Republican, who believe that the federal government should play a stronger, more active, more direct role in the economy, who are in favor of the whole spate of welfare and New Deal measures that we've had? What is the division between people such as that and people, whether labeled Democratic or Republican, who feel that you should reduce the power of the central government, that you should decentralize power, that you should give more role to the states, and so on? This is a division which is popularly referred to, though I think those are misleading labels too, as conservative versus liberal. Now, the fascinating thing is that for the past 10 years, the House of Representatives has typically had a conservative majority, whether Democratic or Republican. The only real exception to that was in the 2 years prior, after Johnson's landslide. That landslide caused an unrepresentative House, as it were, to be elected. The coattails pulled in the eastern wing, as it were, of the Republican and the Democratic Party, with the result that 64 to 66 saw an enormous spate of legislation, Medicare, aid to education, and so on. It's, from my point of view, very unfortunate legislation. But nonetheless, you will note that after the 1966 midterm elections restored Congress to its normal relationship, then Johnson started having enormous difficulty with Congress in getting these measures through, and he couldn't get them through. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you look at Congress in terms of its division by beliefs and not by party labels, then this is a Nixon Congress. This is a Congress which believes the same kind of things that Nixon believes. That's why it is that there's no inconsistency at all, in my opinion, between the electoral results, which showed a great revolt against the existing president,
That is to say, if you add up the Nixon and the Wallace votes, which is what you really have to do from this point of view, you have a substantial vote of no confidence in the present administration. On the one hand, you had that. On the other, you had a return of essentially the same Congress. I don't think there's any inconsistency in that. What that reflects was the difference before the election between the makeup of the Congress on the one hand and the character of the presidency on the other. So I personally do not believe that the democratic nature of the House of Representatives or the narrowness of the election, either one, involves a significant restraint upon the economic policy that Mr. Nixon will be able to pursue.
You think he'll have a pretty easy time of it then for the next at least two years?
Oh, no. No, I don't say that. I think that he will not be handicapped by political problems of this kind, but unfortunately, the economic problems which he faces will provide all the difficulty that any one man might want. I think that Mr. Nixon comes into the White House with a heritage from the economic policy of the Johnson administration, which makes his position from that point of view a very unenviable one.
Are you saying his hands are somewhat tied as he assumes office?
Yes, his hands are tied in one part, but it's a different thing. After all, he inherits the state of the various problems which were left by the policy of the preceding administration. As I mentioned last week, I think the three major problems that are going to be facing the Nixon administration in the economic sphere, the three major broad problems, neglecting for the moment such problems as the problems of the cities and so on, which are in some ways more important. But if you look at the broad economic problems, the three major ones are inflation on the one hand, balance of payments, second, and getting control of the budget. And in each of these, the crucial thing is that Mr. Nixon comes in after an administration which has left the economy in a critical position. The Kennedy administration came into office under favorable circumstances. At the time Mr. Kennedy came into office in the first place, you had had stable prices, you had broken the inflationary expectations of the public, there was some leeway in the economy so you could have rapid economic expansion by absorbing unemployed without having to, without a problem of inflation. And so Kennedy inherited a favorable bequest, as it were, from his predecessor. Now, Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Johnson, between them, have in the last 8 years squandered this bequest by pushing too hard, by promoting very rapid expansion, by encouraging the Federal Reserve Board in a very expansionary policy. On the average over that period, there have been ups and downs. The effect was, and reinforced, of course, by the Vietnam War, what has happened is that you have converted a stable price expansion, a steady expansion, into a very rapid inflationary expansion. You now have prices, consumer prices rising at something like 5% per year, whereas at the end of the Eisenhower era, they were going up at the rate of about 1% a year, and most of that was probably quality change and not a real price change. So now it's a very different thing to come into an economy which has a stable price history and keep it on a non-inflationary course, and to come into an economy which has a very rapidly rising price history, and to keep that on a stable course. That's with inflation. Next, you go to the balance of payments. Now, there, I must, in all fairness, admit that Mr. Kennedy did not come into a good situation either. There was a great balance of payments deficit in 1960. There was a kind of a mini-gold crisis at the time, and therefore, from that point of view, you did have a real problem. But even in that area, the preceding 8 years have moved us farther away from where we want to be than we were before. When Mr. Kennedy came in, there were essentially no exchange controls. Our gold stock, I now do not remember the exact figure, but it was probably somewhere not far from double where it is now. If I remember rightly, it was somewhere in the $15 to $20 billion range, so it was much higher. Now, after 8 years of the Kennedy-Johnson administration, our gold stock has been cut in half. It's now down to less than $10 billion. We have introduced a whole series of foreign exchange controls, including an interest equalization tax, which is a concealed devaluation of the dollar, including control over the lending of U.S. commercial banks abroad, including control over the investment activities of private enterprises. This was the latest measure, which Mr. Johnson took early in January, imposing formal explicit exchange control on private investment. We have seen, in addition to this, the erection of a great many gadgets and gimmicks designed to conceal the true difficulties in the balance of payments. These include special kinds of bonds. You will remember that Bob Broza was Undersecretary of the Treasury at the beginning of this period, and he invented something which were called Rosa bonds, which I always said at the time were really sub-Rosa bills, because they were supposed to look as if they were long-term securities and thus not be a deficit. These were things which he got the central banks to acquire, so that on paper it looked as if they were lending us money on a long-term, but in fact they had an agreement attached to them that at any time they could be turned into short-term assets, into essentially bills which could be drawn down upon. So we've had an enormous proliferation of these devices, as a result of which our fundamental balance of payments is really worse than it looks on the surface. So that, as I say, in this respect, too, in the balance of payments respect, too, Mr. Nixon comes into an extremely difficult situation where you not only have to follow a good policy now, but you have to unwind all of the bad things that have been done, particularly along the lines of controls. You will recall that during the campaign, Mr. Nixon stressed his dissatisfaction, particularly with the investment controls, but also with other exchange controls, and I know he is determined to move in a direction to free the nation from controls. But that itself is a very difficult problem, and therefore you have a problem of undoing that. And finally, with respect to the third of these problems of the budget, again, Mr. Nixon inherits a very difficult situation. You will recall that the Congress, when it made the tax increase, imposed a surcharge, also imposed on President Johnson the duty of cutting governmental expenditures by $6 billion, with some exceptions, at an annual rate. Now, month after, I have no privy information, and I'm speaking entirely from what I read in the newspapers, and what I say now may be wholly wrong, but I must confess I'm kind of cynical, and I have an evil mind, so I may be conjuring things up. But as I read in the newspaper, month after month, I read a report from the Budget Bureau which says the current figures do not, in fact, show as deep a cut as Mr. Johnson had promised to make and was required to make. But this, says each month's report, is due to special circumstances of this month, and everything is going fine, and the next month is going to turn it around and show it looking better. Well, I hope that's right, but I very much fear that it will turn out that when Mr. Nixon comes into office on January 20th, he will be handed the fait accompli, that very little of that cut has been accomplished, and that if the $6 billion is to be achieved, it will have to be achieved mostly in the next 4 or 5 months of his administration, which will be an almost impossible task. So in all three of these areas, of inflation, balance of payments, and getting control of the government budget, Mr. Nixon comes into a situation which is fraught with great economic difficulties, where he's behind the eight ball to start with. And those are, in my opinion, his basic underlying problems, not so much the problem of whether he will be able to deal with a recalcitrant Congress very effectively.
Well, from what you say, he's not going to have too much time for anything else besides economic problems.
Oh, well, unfortunately, he has many other problems to face. He has the problems of course, the foreign policy problems. And indeed, one of the great difficulties one of the reasons why we ought to dismantle some of these controls, why, in my opinion, we ought to have more rules and less discretionary policy, is a simple, elementary fact that the President of the United States, who is at the top of the heap, simply does not have enough time to handle the enormous variety of problems that comes his way. Now, he, unfortunately, will not have enough time to give to this, and that means that some of these things may, of course, not be given the degree of attention they should. The first thing a president has to do is to assign priorities and decide what are the important issues. Now, the reason I picked out these three problems from among the many problems which the president faces is because it seems to me these are the three that will have to be at the top of his priority list. The other problems of what you do about the cities of tax credits, about what you do about the housing problem, what you do about jobs and so on, the minor part. These are part of this, the broad problems I've mentioned, but they will unfortunately have to take a back seat to handling of some of these problems.
Well, Dr. Friedman, perhaps we can take a closer look at some of the problems, economically speaking, that will be facing Mr. Nixon when he assumes office during our next discussion next week.
That will be our plan. I had hoped today to get farther than I did into the more detailed problems of inflation. Maybe next week we can start right off on what his problems will be in the inflation area. Thank you, Mr. Shepard.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Milton Friedman. If you have questions or comments or suggestions for topics you'd like to have discussed in this series, please send them to Instructional Dynamics Incorporated, 166 East Superior Street, Chicago, Illinois, 60611.